You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking with a historian who has studied presidential elections for decades and is known for predicting the winner of presidential elections by asking 13 key questions. And his prediction is in for November. Who do you think is going to win the presidential election and why? What issues will matter most to voters this November? How much trust do you have in poll numbers? We're at 800-642-1234. Alan Lichtman is a distinguished professor of history at American University, and he's successfully predicted every presidential election since 1984, including President Trump's surprise victory in 2016. Alan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's cut to the chase. Who are you predicting is going to win in November?
Well, based upon my 13 keys to the White House, which gauge the strength and performance of the party holding the White House, it takes 6 negative keys to predict their defeat. That would be Donald Trump and the Republicans. And late 2019, Donald Trump only had 4 negative keys, but his failed response to the many crises that have arisen in 2020 have resulted in the most sudden and dramatic reversal of fortune in the history of the United States. In a matter of a few months, 3 more keys have turned against the incumbent Donald Trump. With 7 negative keys against him, Trump is a predicted loser in his bid for re-election in November.
Explain how you see your keys as it's governing and not the campaigning that counts to flip this a key from true to false.
Exactly. The keys are based upon the insight that American presidential elections are primarily votes up or down on how well the party holding the White House has governed. Speeches, debates, ads, the tricks of the campaign, fundraising, all these conventional measures have virtually no impact on the outcome of the election. The keys tell you to keep your eye on the big picture of incumbent party strength and performance. So they look at things like midterm elections, a midterm referendum on the incumbent president, third parties, long and short-term economy, scandal, social unrest, policy change, foreign policy successes and failures. And only 2 keys have anything to do with the candidates, and they are very high threshold keys, asking whether the incumbent party candidate or the challenging party candidate is one of those once-in-a-generation inspirational, charismatic candidates like Ronald Reagan in the 1980s or Barack Obama in 2008.
Your method, though, has been criticized, particularly for using candidates' charisma, as you mentioned there, as predictors. How do you measure a subjective thing like charisma?
It's not strictly subjective. When I first came up with the keys, I was blasted by the professional forecasting for using judgment in calling some of the keys. And I kept telling people, this is the human world. This is the social world. You have to use judgment. Historians use judgment all the time. It took about 10 years for the professional forecasters to realize the attempt to have purely cut and dried objective models don't work, and that the best models are those like the keys, which combine objective indicators like economic growth with judgmental indicators like charisma. I twice then keynoted the International Forecasting Summit, and the keys became the hottest thing in forecasting. It may sound subjective, but it isn't. First of all, there's a track record of the keys going all the way back to 1860. So you've got to judge whether you think someone is charismatic or not with how it's been answered for low these many years. Secondly, when you buy my book, Predicting the Next President, which just came out in its 2020 edition, I explain what I mean by charisma. And that is a candidate who stands out as this extraordinary, once-in-a-generation candidate with this broad, charismatic appeal. It's reflected in polling on the candidate. It's reflected in commentary on the candidate. And I stress, it has to be broad appeal. It can't be just to the strong partisans of that candidate. And I don't think there'd be any dispute about who these candidates have been. Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, Barack Obama in 2008.
We're talking with Alan Lichtman. He is a distinguished professor of history at American University. He developed 13 questions, as we're talking about, that guide his prediction to the outcome of a presidential election. You can join in. Have you made up your mind who you will vote for in November's presidential election? What determined who you will vote for? Join in at 800-642-1234. So, Alan, there's still roughly 3 months to go before the presidential election. Could circumstances change? Could these keys change ahead of November?
No. I mean, not likely, let me put it that way. I never categorically would say no. The keys are the big picture. They're not manipulable. They don't turn on who's up, who's down day to day in the campaign. You don't suddenly change the situation abroad, although it could change rapidly and usually negatively. The economy doesn't just change on a dime. Social unrest doesn't go away overnight. But there are two things outside the realm of the keys or any prediction system that do keep me awake at night. One is voter suppression. Donald Trump and his Republicans depend upon old white guys like me, the most shrinking part of the electorate. They can't manufacture more old white guys, but they can try to suppress the vote of the rising Democratic base of minority and young voters. That worries me. The other thing that worries me is Russian intervention. We know the Russians are coming back. They're already doing it. And they probably learned a lot in 4 years. And they even try to get into registration rolls. And we know that as in 2016, Donald Trump will welcome and exploit any Russian intervention on his behalf. Those two things are quite chilling.
Looking at Vice President Biden, there is anxious await of Biden to pick a running mate. How much could that change the dynamics of the race?
Not at all. There's no key for the vice presidency, and the vice presidency does not turn the race. I recall back in 1988 when George H.W. Bush picked the very lightly regarded Dan Quayle. The conventional wisdom was, oh, my God, this is going to sink his campaign. Of course, it had absolutely no effect on the campaign. When George W. Bush's son picked Dick Cheney, the conventional wisdom was, Oh my gosh, Cheney has no political clout. No one's ever heard of him. It made no difference. But let me say this. Substantively, the vice presidential pick can matter. You're dealing with someone who'll be 78 years old when he enters the White House. And, you know, you've got to have some worry that maybe the vice presidential pick could become the president.
American University distinguished history professor Alan Lichtman is our guide as he explains his prediction for the outcome of the November election and his method behind it. Based on his criteria, he is predicting President Trump will lose the election. What do you make of his prediction? What questions do you have about his formula? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Alan Lichtman here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking with American University history professor Alan Lichtman on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 4 decades ago, Lichtman developed a presidential election prediction model that has accurately called presidential elections from President Reagan to President Trump. His method comes down to 13 questions, and he's made his prediction for November that Vice President Joe Biden will defeat President Trump. What do you make of his forecasting tool and the reasoning? Many of the polls predicted Hillary Clinton would win in 2016. Do you think the country will see another upset in November? It's 800-642-1234, and historian Ellen Lichtman stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Christopher is joining us from Brookfield. Hi, Christopher. Hi, Christopher. Can you hear us? I think we're having trouble hearing Christopher. Christopher says, Ellen, Christopher plans to vote for Biden back in 2016. Trump and Hillary Clinton, Christopher says, were both popular and that thought they would be a one-term president. And President Trump is more unpopular now, Christopher thinks. Can you look at the changes that happened between 2016 and the present, Ellen?
Critical thing that differentiates Trump in 2016 from Trump now is Trump is the incumbent. This means Trump is running on his record. He had no record to defend in 2016. He could say whatever he wanted. It didn't matter. But he made a tremendous mistake as the incumbent president. I'm looking on my wall here in my study, and I have a note on my Washington Post prediction of Trump's win in 2016. It says, Professor, congrats, good call, and in big Sharpie letters, Donald J. Trump. He acknowledged my prediction, but he didn't understand the thesis behind the keys, which is that governing, not campaigning, counts. So when he was confronted with the big crises of 2020, the pandemic, the demands for social justice, instead of dealing with them substantively, he thought he could talk his way out of them. The result is the pandemic is raging, the economy is plunging, social unrest stalks the land, and these turned three keys against him.
I want to see if Christopher is there. Christopher, can you hear us?
Can you hear me at all?
Yeah, we can hear you.
All right.
What do you think of Alan's response there about the change from 2016 and the present and how President Trump has handled these crises?
Yeah, it seemed a lot of people, a lot of voters were projecting what they wanted onto Trump, things that they believed that he stood for when he never really said he stood for anything. I've heard like LGBT people say that, oh, he supports gay rights because he waved rainbow flag one time, but he never once really said that he did. And then the vice president he picked has a horrible record when it comes to the rights of gay and lesbian Americans. But this time around, you can't really project those ideas onto him anymore because he's had time in office and his actions speak louder than his words at times now. You can't hide behind words and a record that doesn't exist anymore.
Ellen, what do you see there in Christopher's words?
Well, he's exactly right. This is my point. It's governing, not campaigning, that counts. Trump is now running on his record, and he can't talk his way out of his record. No matter how many words he issues, it's not going to erase what's actually happening in the country, which is the basis of the voters' decision.
Let's bring in Mike now in Shell Lake. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Good. Go ahead.
I would like to say that I don't think Trump's record is the problem with the prediction that he's making out of Trump loss in the election. It's wishful thinking on the left. You're trying to run a candidate with clear dementia problems and actually quite racist in the past. So I don't think the record that you're talking about with Trump is nearly as bad as Biden's. That's my prediction.
All right, Mike. You know, Alan, Mike sees this very differently about President Trump's record.
Well, you can see where Mike is coming from. I'm not making a prediction from the left. My predictions are purely impartial. I have called out of 9 elections, 4 Republicans, 5 Democrats. That is as even-handed as you can get. And as you can imagine, in 2016, I was not very popular in 90% plus Washington, D.C., where I teach, calling the election for Donald Trump. With all respect, the caller reflects the conventional wisdom that an election is between the two candidates, whereas the T's are based on a very different and successful proposition that the T's are that the elections turn on the evaluations of the record of the incumbent. Just comparing the two candidates, Hillary Clinton should have won in a landslide. She won all the debates. She was ahead on all of the issues. She was more experienced. Donald Trump was caught on tape bragging about sexual assault of women. You can't evaluate elections that way.
We're talking with Alan Lichtman, Distinguished Professor of History at American University. He is out with his prediction that Vice President Joe Biden will defeat President Trump in the November election. What do you want to know about his key questions? What insights do you have about the election? What are you thinking? 800-642-1234. Alan, you know, the polls in 2016, as you mentioned, showed Hillary Clinton as a strong favorite in the election. Should we be paying attention to polling?
No. I mean, I have nothing against the pollsters. They're friends of mine. They do their jobs well. But polls are misused. Polls are snapshots. They are not predictors. They're not designed to be predictors. They tell you where people say they stand at a given moment. That can change very rapidly over time. And how do you know whether things have changed? You take another poll and so on and so on. But polls are tethered to no reality. The other problem is you're not actually polling voters, so you have to estimate who the likely voters are, and that obviously introduces error. So when the pollsters say our margin of error is plus or minus 3 or 4 points, that's statistical error. That doesn't take into account error from misestimating likely voters or people not telling you the truth.
Let's bring in Jay now in Birchwood. Hi, Jay.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Just a quick comment and then a quick question. First of all, I hope the professor is dead on, but I think Trump has proven that conventional wisdom in lots of cases is thrown out the window. But my question is, how much weight has he taken with the social media and its effects on election? Because honestly, I don't think without social media, Trump wins the last election. In fact, I don't think he's close.
Jay, thank you. Alan, what is the impact of Twitter?
None on my system. Look, my system goes all the way back to 1860, when we didn't even have radio, much less television or online media. The mechanisms of campaigning and elections have changed fundamentally over the course of time when the keys have held. The keys are a very robust system. You know, every 4 years, I get the criticism, oh, your keys can't work now because something's changed. We have an African-American running. We never had that before. We have a woman running. Never had that before. We now have social media. Never had that before. And all that's correct, but the keys are not based upon those kinds of changes. They, again, are based on the big picture of incumbent strength and performance.
How do you expect the pandemic, the recession, the Black Lives Matter movement, how could that change politics going forward in our country?
Well, I hope it does. I think demands for racial justice need to be met. You're not going to solve racial justice in this country by sending federal law enforcement officers into the cities. That only fans the flames of discontent. It doesn't resolve them. And we saw in the pandemic, we need a greatly fortified federal government. We need a federal government that is very strong in public health. We need a president who is surrounded, not just surrounded by competent people, but who listens to competent people, who follows the science, and who deals with problems substantively and not just tries to talk
his way around and out of the problems. These are huge issues facing the country. But I would hope, just like the Great Depression was a catalyst for positive social change, these crises will be as well.
Alan, thank you for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Alan Lichtman is a distinguished professor of history at American University. Coming up, we have the head of the Milwaukee Election Commission to find out how the city is preparing for Tuesday's primary. Will you vote in person Tuesday, or did you request an absentee ballot? What do you want to know about voting in Milwaukee? It's 800-642-1234. We'll talk about casting a ballot in Milwaukee after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on how Milwaukee is preparing to carry out Tuesday's partisan primary. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers said this week he would call up the National Guard to help run Tuesday's primary because of a shortage of hundreds of poll workers. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a typical August primary requires 25,000 to 30,000 poll workers. Some past workers are declining to assist at the polls due to health issues that put them at greater risk of contracting COVID. Will you go to the polls Tuesday, or did you request an absentee ballot? Are you casting your ballot in a different way than you did in April? What was your experience voting in the spring election? It's 800-642-1234. Claire Woodall-Vogue was appointed as executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission last month. She's worked for the commission since 2013. Claire, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We'll start by explaining to us what the city has learned after we saw the long lines in April's election and polling locations reduced down to five. What were the lessons learned?
I think the most important thing is that we've had time to plan and to expand our polling places. By no means have we ever stated that April 7th went well. You summed it up. It was due to a poll worker shortage. But over the summer, we have worked diligently to do a tremendous amount of outreach with our community partners and recruited new election workers, as well as been able to train our chief inspectors, our election workers on safety protocols, and really do all of the planning that it takes to open up 168 polling locations next Tuesday.
So 168 locations. And what about a shortage of poll workers? Are you finding enough for Tuesday?
Yeah, so we are very fortunate. Over the summer, we worked with community partners like Souls to the Polls, Wisconsin Voices, the SEIU, who really helped us to recruit over 700 new election workers who we have been training virtually. And so we are not having a poll worker shortage for next Tuesday. Now, I would never want to have that change. And so I have, since we have activated the National Guard, requested that we have 50 guardsmen on standby to be what we call on-call election inspectors. Because with COVID, we always have things like people who suddenly are worried that they have symptoms or they have had a positive test over the weekend. And we don't want any worker to show up on Tuesday out of a sense of obligation. So we're planning and trying to really pad our staffing with those National Guard members in order to have a successful election day.
With 168 locations, how many would you normally have for an August primary?
180 polling locations. We have tried to open every single polling location, but 12 of them, either due to construction, like some of our parks facilities, or just not quite yet being comfortable opening to the public in the case of some of our private facilities, have changed. All voters who plan to vote next Tuesday should double check their polling place at myvote.wi.gov. And they also would have gotten last week, letting them know of the polling place change.
We're talking with Claire Woodall-Vogue, who is executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission, and we're talking about Tuesday's primary, how the commission is ramping up to have polls ready to go. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Claire, what precautions is the city taking to keep poll workers and voters safe at the polls? What about PPE, personal protection equipment?
Yeah, so the very first thing I did earlier this summer before I was director was I really worked closely with the Department of Public Works to place a very large order for plexiglass. We have plexiglass tabletop shields at every table in the polling place, which has made our poll workers definitely feel a lot safer. We also have plenty of hand sanitizer.
And I think we're having trouble hearing Claire Woodall-Vogue. And we're talking about Tuesday's primary. Will you vote in person on Tuesday, or did you ask for an absentee ballot? How did you decide how to vote? Has the pandemic kept you from voting? What would make it easier for you? What questions do you have about the voting process in Milwaukee? You can join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Should Wisconsin switch to all mail-in voting systems for all elections the way some states do, or should in-person voting be the standard? How have you requested your ballot, and have you sent it back yet? Did you vote in person in Milwaukee in April? How long did you wait in line, and what was the experience like? You can call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org as we work to get a connection here with Claire Woodall-Vogue, who was appointed executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission last month. She has worked for the commission since 2013, and we're getting a read on how the commission is preparing for Tuesday, as we did see long lines heading into April's election. And what do you hope will be different in Tuesday's election? Will you vote in person, or did you request an absentee ballot? Have you returned your absentee ballot yet? If not, what is holding you back? You can join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. As Claire had said earlier, there will be 168 locations open. Normally, there would have been about 180 locations, and she said to go to the My Vote website to ensure you know where your polling location is. And she also said the National Guard will be on standby as to ensure that there are enough poll workers in Milwaukee and that the polling locations are staffed appropriately. Are you a poll worker? Have you volunteered in the past? Maybe this is your first time working the polls. What has brought you out, or what has kept you back from being a poll worker in the August primary? You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we work to establish connection here with Claire Woodall-Vogue, and we're talking about Tuesday's primary election. Governor Evers said earlier this week that he would call up the National Guard to help run Tuesday's primary due to a shortage of hundreds of poll workers, a shortage that Claire currently is not seeing in Milwaukee as the Milwaukee Election Commission ramps up for the August primary. But according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a typical August primary requires 25,000 to 30,000 poll workers, and some past workers are declining to help at the polls due to that their health conditions that have put them at greater risk of contracting COVID-19. So what are the circumstances like for you? What do you think of the surge in absentee voting, and how did you request your ballot? Will you go to the polls Tuesday? Are you casting your ballot in a different way than you did in April? And what was your experience like in April? You can join in 800-642-1234. We're going to work here for just more a moment. We do have technical issues trying to talk with Claire Woodall-Vogue, and we'll try to shore that up. Stay with us. We will get back to this conversation here on the Ideas Network. 2011 to 2015. Tim, in 2008, Governor Jim Doyle appointed you to a task force to save the GM plant. What was that like? What were those first meetings like? What did you do?
Well, the first thing we did was we got everybody in the same team. So we had business and labor and Republicans and Democrats in the community, everybody pulling together to try to get GM to change their mind. They had announced that they were going to close the plant. They announced in June of 08 that they were going to close the plant by 2010. So we thought we had some time. We thought we had the rest of 08, maybe some of 09. And then we went to Detroit, Governor Doyle and Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, Democratic Governor, Republican Congressman. We went to Detroit with a group, and we made our presentation, and they said, this was in September of 08, and they said they had not made up their final, they had not made a final decision to close the plant. So we went back and put together a $200 million plus package of incentives to get them to stay, which at that time was actually considered a decent number. The Foxconn number kind of makes that number look small, that's for sure, but Foxconn's a whole other story.
Yeah, we'll get to Foxconn in a moment. But what did this task force teach you about how government is involved in whether a manufacturer stays or goes?
Well, what it taught me, probably taught me a lot of things, but it taught me that the corporation, especially if it's an out-of-state corporation, is going to do what they need to do to be a profitable, successful company. And if that includes closing the plant in my hometown, it gets beyond, you know, details like that. It really comes down to political clout. Do you have somebody representing you who General Motors really has to care about, far beyond Janesville, in other words, in Washington, D.C.? We had that back in the 80s, early 90s with Les Aspin, the late congressman, who was chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and GM had lots of defense contracts. So they really cared about the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. We lost him. He died in 1995. And we had nobody with that kind of clout in the Wisconsin congressional delegation, clout that GM cared about. Paul Ryan, people say, well, Paul Ryan became speaker. But Paul Ryan was not the speaker in 08. He was a junior member in the minority party in the House of Representatives at the time. So, we just didn't have clout, which was really going to be the only way that I think we could ultimately save it, because what we didn't know, as I say in the book, what we didn't know made all the difference. General Motors was going broke, and we didn't know that. I don't think anybody in the Janesville plant knew how bad the shape they were in. And General Motors is going broke. Gas prices go to $4 a gallon, and these big SUVs that we were making so profitably and successfully stopped selling. And General Motors had way too much capacity. They had way too many plants, and they were closing plants. They closed 28 plants between 07 and 09. Unfortunately, we were one of them.
Matt from Wausau emailed to say that GM made huge gas-guzzling cars long after the market had switched over to more economical, smaller vehicles, that GM could have retooled to meet demand in Janesville, but for whatever reason, they didn't. What do you think about that analysis?
I think he's correct. General Motors made a decision back in the 70s and 80s that they would stick with the profitable, bigger vehicles and not directly challenge the Japanese models that were coming over, the Toyota and Hondas. And they paid a long-term price for that. And part of the reason why they did that was because they couldn't make as much money on those smaller, fuel-efficient vehicles as they could on the big ones. So they were fine as long as gas prices stayed under control and that they weren't. But they didn't deal with a lot of their costs, which I talked about in the book. The other thing I would say is we were pretty sure that they were going to move this SUV product that we were making to Arlington, Texas, which was the other place they were making the same vehicle. But they had a fuel-efficient, smaller vehicle called the Chevy Spark. And we were really, at the end, trying to get them to give us the Chevy Spark as a replacement vehicle and keep the plant open. We eventually lost that effort, too, when we lost it to Michigan. And no surprise, Michigan's represented by a fellow who just passed away, Representative John Dingell, who was the Michigan's version of our Les Aspin back in the 80s. He chaired the committee in Congress, which controlled fuel efficient standards and miles per gallon standards for vehicles. General Motors cared very much about John Dingell. And lo and behold, we did not get the Chevy Spark either. That went to Michigan.
Near the end of your book, Tim, you reflect on whether the government could have done anything to save the plant from closing. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, you have to start with, what does GM care about? And they cared about Congress, and they cared about all the standards, vehicle standards that could come out of laws that could help them or hurt them. So they cared about the Congress, and they needed $25 billion. And state governments don't have an extra $25 billion, nor do state governments decide the national fuel efficient standards. So the key to saving the thing is you have to have power in Washington.
Talking with Tim Cullen, a former state senator, author of the new book, Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors. There's a line for you. What do you remember about the GM plant in Janesville? What stories about the factory can you share? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tim, in December last year, Governor Scott Walker's administration brokered this $28 million deal to prevent Kimberly-Clark from closing its factory in Neenah. And Kimberly-Clark said the deal kept about 2,400 jobs in the state. How do you feel about that deal, given your own experiences trying to save the Janesville plant?
Well, I'm happy it happened. It saved a whole lot of jobs. It all depends on what the company really wants to do. I don't know how serious they were about leaving, but they certainly got the state government's attention. That's the problem with subsidies. You never know whether they really need them or whether they're able to get them. Political leaders have a big obligation to try to save jobs in their state, not only for the workers, but for their own career. It is not helpful to public officials in power to have companies moving out of their state.
You argue that we should be concerned about plants run by these out-of-state corporations or corporations with just one factory in Wisconsin. What are your concerns there?
Well, if we are the only, for example, the large employer that we're talking about, in this case GM, if they're owned by an out-of-state corporation, then you especially have to worry if you are the only assembly plant, in this case, that GM has in Wisconsin. And that was the case in 2008. It was the only assembly plant GM had. So GM, if they closed the plant, they didn't have to worry about Wisconsin politicians not being happy with them because they'd be gone. And that was a situation we found ourselves in. There's a lot of debate going on now about whether financial incentives really affect what a company does or not. But what you're always going to see is the elected officials always trying to offer them. But there's
regardless of market forces,
right? And if you think about a large corporation like General Motors, they would say, and that's probably accurate, they can't afford to worry about a particular plant, a particular community. They've got this, multi-billion-dollar corporation in several communities across the country, and especially when they're going broke and their own CEO's job is on the line, like it was in 2008, they can hardly afford to worry about a community, one community, Janesville.
Let's take a moment to talk about Foxconn. If Wisconsin could put together a $4 billion deal to attract Foxconn, why couldn't it build a package of similar size to keep General Motors?
Well, we're talking about, really, even though it's only 10 years or so, it's a different era. I don't think Wisconsin had $4 billion to be trying to get General Motors to stay. Where was it? The taxpayers would probably be in revolt 11 years ago, and I think the Foxconn deal is going to. I can't help but think that it's going to end up the same way that a lot of what happened in Janesville, which is robots. robots were a major reason why the GM plant in Janesville went from 7,100 workers in the early 1970s to about 3,500 at the time they closed. It was other efficiencies, but largely robots. And why Foxconn? Because really, any assembly line job, which is created by its nature to be repetitive, can potentially be replaced by a robot. And that's robots don't they don't call in sick, and they don't have pensions, they don't have to pay, and they're I'll be surprised if my own prediction is that there's going to be an awful lot of robots at Foxconn.
We're talking with former State Senator Tim Cullen about his new book called Disassembled. It looks at the closure of the Janesville GM plant, what happened now a decade removed, and what is life today, and how cities all over fare after the loss of a big manufacturer. Your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Tim Cullen here on the Ideas Network.